So actually, I'm working my way into geometric inequalities. I thought I would. I sketched at the very beginning of the semester this Schrödinger proof of the isoparametric theorem, and I thought that I would sketch another. It was heuristic anyway. So I mean, so I thought I would sketch another circle of ideas that are connected with isoperimetry and inequalities concerning convex bodies. And the treatment that I'm going to give is it's more or less inspired by this paper of Olesker, Dar, and Milman. Although I now have some ideas about how to eliminate some of the technical problems in this paper, which are actually related to the proof I sketched last week of Alexandrov's theorem. So, and actually, I haven't even told you what the inequalities are, but anyhow, this is a huge family of inequalities associated with convex bodies. And transportation only allows you to address some of them. It certainly doesn't allow you to address all of them. So let's see. The idea is the following, and isoperimetry. So if I have two sets, K0 and K1, which a priori might not be convex, although at sometimes I will want them to be convex. So you define the set of all things which can be written as a vector combination of two things in these two sets. And similarly for a scalar, I guess the most famous inequality concerning objects of this kind is the Brin-Minkowski inequality. Which is a kind of backwards triangle inequality. It says that it's supposed to compare the volume of K0 plus K1 to the volume of K0 plus the volume of K1. Except, of course, these volumes scale like the nth power of T under dilations. So the thing that ought to scale linearly is the nth root of this volume. And and then it's a backwards triangle inequality. Or equivalently, if I replace k naught by 1 minus tk naught and k1 by 1 minus tk1, because of this homogeneity, I can pull out, after the Brunmann-Kesky inequality, I can pull out the factor of 1 minus t. And that says that this is a concave function of t. And I guess the cases of equality are that equality holds strictly unless k naught equals tk1. Some t. And both sets are convex. For which did I say? K naught is a homothetic copy of K1. So this has something to do with the isoperimetric inequality. Let me see if I... So Brunmann-Kesky implies the isoperimetric inequality. By the following argument. So if I fix some k-naught... And I want to know something about the perimeter of K0. One way of getting at the perimeter is you look at an epsilon neighborhood of K0. And so you notice that, in fact, let me just call this K. In fact, if I define K epsilon to be the set of points X, such that the distance from x to k is less than epsilon, then this is also it's also k plus epsilon times the ball of radius 1 around 0. So, and on the other hand, somehow the difference, so this layer has thickness epsilon, and so we understand that the volume of the difference divided by epsilon ought to converge to the perimeter. So. Let's say for nice sets, e.g. smooth or piecewise smooth. This would be the limit as epsilon tends to 0 of the difference between these two volumes. And so the Brudnikovsky inequality gives me a way to estimate So let's see. So this is basically the derivative of the Brudnikovsky inequality gives me a way to estimate this derivative, namely, actually, it gives me rather a way to estimate the derivative of if I let F epsilon be the volume to the 1 over n of K epsilon, then F prime of epsilon would be 1 over n times the volume to the 1 over n minus 1 of K epsilon d by d epsilon of volume K epsilon. And so F prime of 0 would be 1 over n times the volume to the 1 minus n over n of K0, which is K. And this is the thing that we're interested in. So let's, so this would be 1 over n, perimeter of H. So if I have a bound on below for this thing, then in principle I have a bound on below for the perimeter of K. And so what this inequality here gives me is a bound on below for F prime of 0. But zero of volume K plus epsilon D1 and this thing I can estimate as being bigger than something using Brudnikovsky. This is bigger than the volume to the 1 over n of epsilon B1. And the epsilon comes out of here, and so this is and so when I put that estimate together in there, it tells me that this is bigger than volume to the 1 over n of the unit ball. That's a a formal sketch of a proof of the isoparametric theorem. And this formal idea can be made rigorous, actually. Although, I'm not going to try to do it. So this was actually at the basis of a proof of the isoparametric theorem, maybe due to Minkowski, or even Brun. This one here? This idea is actually used to give rigorous proofs of the isoparametric theorem in various places, and one place that's coming to me is in a paper from the last 20 years by Fonseca and Stefan Müller, where they're actually looking at a slightly more general problem where you maybe have a direction dependent perimeter. I mean, you don't make the surface energy isotropic. You say certain directions are going to cost more than others. So this thing holds in wonderful generality, actually. This holds for, I think you don't even need the sets K1 and K0 to be measurable as long as you interpret volume as being the outer measure. And of course, these derivatives may not exist, but you get inequalities somewhere in here. And ultimately, you want the isoparametric theorem for sets of finite perimeter, would be the natural class of competitors. Why am I sketching these ideas? So this inequality I'm going to come back to, but probably next week. And so far this story holds for general sets. They don't need to be convex. Convexity only occurs as a condition for equality to hold. Of course, there are two parts of the isoparametric theorem. One is to show that balls have the minimum perimeter, and the other one is to show that balls are the only set that have the minimum perimeter. I think Fonseca and Müller do both. So now let me come back to Alexandrov-Senkel inequalities. So, the Alexandrov-Senkel inequalities deal with objects like this. And essentially what the Brun-Minkowski inequality is telling us is something like the coefficient of t in an expansion of this thing. I mean, this is a constant plus some power of some constant. It's a constant plus something of order t plus something of order t squared, and so on. And you can also ask about the coefficients of the higher powers of t in this theory. And so let's see the theory of mixed volumes. Claims, first of all, that let me write it this way. This is claim one. So now I guess I take K1, K0, and K1 to be convex. Then this thing is a polynomial of degree n. So in other words, I can write it in the form sum from 0 up to n of some powers of t, and then some coefficients, and the coefficients actually I did it this way depend on K naught and K one. Sorry, this is on I. And I guess that if both of these were, let's say, the unit ball, then I would have the volume of the unit ball times 1 plus t to the nth power. And so 1 plus t to the nth power is t to the n times n choose k. And so it's customary to normalize these coefficients with the n and choose k n. So this is actually the definition of the VNIs. Thank you. Other comments or corrections? Thank you. So when I did it in my notes, I used little k as the index, and now since I'm using capital K as the sets, I decided, oh, I should probably change it. And other questions, comments? No, okay. So the first non-obvious claim is that this is actually a polynomial of degree n, and the second, so this is now, I guess, Alexandrov and Fenkel. Claim is that actually these coefficients satisfy some inequalities with respect to each other, namely the ith coefficient squared is bigger than the product of the I plus 1th coefficient and the I minus 1th coefficient. And claim 2 has lots of corollaries. Is that one of the ones that's interesting for me is that the ith coefficient so this kind of says that the ith coefficient can be bounded below by the size of its neighbors, but then this one can be bounded below by the size of the ith coefficient, the I plus 2th coefficient. This one can be bounded below by the size of the ith coefficient, the I minus 2th coefficient. So I can also bound the VI coefficient in terms of the VI minus 2 and the VI plus 2th coefficient. And I can sort of keep propagating this outwards until I get to the end of the line. So this is for I counting from 1 to n minus 1 in n dimensions. And I can eventually bound everything in terms of the 0th coefficient and the nth coefficient. And but somehow, as I'm doing this, I have to keep track of the powers. And the powers are that I think I over n and n minus I over n. So I should think about that for a second. If I is 0, then I'm basically looking at the volume of K naught. And so I guess this should actually be n minus I, and this should be I. Sorry, this is the volume of K naught. If I is 0, and I want all of that and none of this. Okay, and so this is another thing that implies the isoperimetric inequality. So this also, in particular, So the volume of K naught times the unit ball, this guy would be the volume of K naught. To be n minus 1 over n, this would be the coefficient of t to the n in this expansion, where this is the unit ball, is the volume of the unit ball. And this is the coefficient of epsilon in the previous expansion. And so this is again, well, there's an n out here. N times v is the coefficient of epsilon in the previous expansion. So this is again the isoparametric inequality. An isoparametric inequality. And some of these other, these higher coefficients include topological information about the set. I guess the top coefficient includes topological information. So, that's something like counts the Euler characteristic. And because somehow this would be the coefficient of t squared or epsilon squared, so if k looks like this, union, I don't know, something like this. The coefficient of epsilon in the expansion k plus epsilon b1 somehow measures the perimeter around the boundary. The coefficient of epsilon squared basically comes from, say, these corners. And so you'd get maybe it would have a coefficient of pi for these four corners and another pi for these four corners. But then you would lose a little bit in here, where you actually have less than the perimeter times epsilon, and the amount that you have less is turns out to be minus pi epsilon squared. And so this somehow counts the number of connected components minus number of holes, something like that. Maybe I don't have it quite right, but okay. So that's the kind of information that's contained in these mixed volumes. So I believe so. Yes. Yes. So I guess that I should say I'm actually not expert enough on this scenario. So I know it's true that it's a polynomial when they're non-convex. So So I should. Should say that I don't know anything about the non-convex case. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so maybe it's safer to say that this would count. I mean, so probably I shouldn't be too. I should say that for a union. Well, yeah, you're right. You're right. So there's some problem when I have even two components. For small t, this will count the number of connected components, but then at some point they start to overlap. And I'm not sure how to handle the overlap. No. Okay. So I talk about this a little bit. What can be proved, so this thing here can be proved using optimal transport, and I will sketch that today. And these general inequalities, I don't think can be proved using optimal transport. At least, it might be possible to construct mappings which are helpful in proving these general inequalities, but nobody knows how to do so at the moment. So that's kind of interesting. And this certainly can be proved. This is certainly provable using optimal transport. And I will sketch proof of that also. So can this be proved using mappings? And various people have thought about this question and don't really know the answer. Lesker-Dar and Milman's argument is the following. So let's assume strictly convex, that shouldn't cost anything. I'm what? I'm starting out, I'm first going to prove claim one. And I will later prove crawler 2, yes. But the machinery that I set up to prove claim 1 is subsequently going to prove crawler 2 as well. So, great. So, and so according to Brenier's theorem, there exists, we know, convex functions so actually I need to fix some reference measure, so I would like to first guess compactly supported sets in Rn, so they have finite volume, and so I want my gradients psi naught and psi one to have certain mapping properties. I want to look at the probability measure, which is given by characteristic function of ki over volume of ki. So that's a probability measure. And I want to look at some standard reference measure, which I can take to be the Gaussian on all of Rn. Normalized to have unit mass. And then this is the density of some probability measure. This is the density of some probability measure. And so in each case, there exists a convex function which should map this thing onto this thing. So what I really mean is that So I confuse the measures and their densities. And IE, this Monge-Ampère equation is also going to be satisfied here. So gradient of psi I of Rn is going to be contained in the closure of Ki, and the determinant of the Hessian of psi I at x is going to be given by the ratio of this function to that function, which is e to the minus x squared over does this 2 belong here? Have I correctly normalized my Gaussian on Rn? Thanks. Times this, there's a 1 over Ki here, and so let me put that in here. And so this holds almost everywhere in the sense of Alexandrov. At least almost everywhere in understanding this derivative in the sense of Alexandrov. And so what I would like to do is I would like to look at a convex combination of these two functions, and that's supposed to parameterize let's consider psi naught of x plus t psi 1 of x, and what follows from here is that gradient, so I could call this psi. So for fixed t, and the gradient of psi on Rn is going to be contained in k naught plus tk1. But I actually need something better than this. Closure. So if I only care about this inequality, I can get it using that containment. But if I care about the higher inequalities, the VIs for I bigger than 1 or less than n minus 1, then I really want equality here. And or to prove claim 1. So bigger than 1. Case of corollary 2. I need various things. I need We need to show that this is actually true. And I also would like to know a little bit of smoothness for psi. So, and I think what I can actually expect to have is that psi is C2 alpha. Let's say C2 on our end. And so let's say this is a technical thing that I need, and this is a conceptual thing that I need. And so the technical thing follows from, so this technical thing comes from the theory of Caporelli. Which is essentially an adaptation of the argument that Grégoire Loper showed us 2 weeks ago gets to C1 alpha here, adapted to this context. I.e., so even if you weren't here, Greg didn't even he didn't show it in this context. He showed it in the context of viscosity solutions to the Monge-Ampère equation with Dirichlet boundary conditions that you could expect a C1 alpha estimate sketched. And then I guess the Krylov-Evans estimate that Don sketched a couple weeks ago is somehow is the key idea in getting from C1 alpha to C2 alpha. From C2 to C2 alpha. And okay. So let's see. I mean, one. So. Okay. Or Monge-Ampère. Okay. So actually, so I somehow I also want to leave the technical stuff to the experts, and but I will say something about this conceptual thing. Which is why does this cover? That's true. Yeah. So, what do I mean? Yeah, so what you could show with what you could show using a containment like this is that the volume of K naught plus TK1 is bigger than the volume of K naught plus T N volume of k naught to the 1 over nth power volume of k sorry to the n minus 1 over nth power volume of so you could show something like this just from this containment. The containment basically says if I can estimate this thing here, that gives me a lower bound on this volume here. And so that lower bound is going to, would end up having a form like this. I'm sorry, what? Yeah, so somehow somehow this thing already gets at the, this thing here already gets at the isoperimetric part of the story, and it's when you want to get at these higher order mixed volumes that's, that you really want this equality here. And so that's somehow why I'm going through some of this stuff this a little bit, well, so I'm going to go through this point, it's not hard. Well, let's see. I would have thought that one place you use that assumption is here. Yeah, in fact, so... Yeah, so, this holds on all of our N. So if my target was, say, just consists of two disjoint components separated by some distance, then my function would have to somehow have a tear in it. But, I mean, it would have to... That's true. The image of the subgradient is convex.
Yeah.
That's true. That's what I think. And the fact that I have these convex targets here is somehow giving me the smoothness. Yeah. And so I'm not quite sure how that jives with your comment now. Right. So here I said, okay, it holds almost everywhere. Of course, this thing may have some. If I were to replace this almost everywhere derivative by something like a distributional derivative, there might be some a measure theoretic part, sort of a concentrated part of the map. And the assumption of convexity of k0 and k1 is what precludes there from being any part of this measure which is not absolutely continuous with respect to Lebesgue. So I should come back to this point. That d2 psi I is absolutely continuous with respect to Lebesgue. So in other words, I'm seeing the whole right-hand side in this case of this equation. There's no part hidden on a set of zero volume. Right. That's true. And so I could replace this by subdifferential. And I guess that it doesn't make any difference as long as the KIs are convex and this combination is convex, whether I write subdifferential or... Yes, okay. Right. Okay. Thanks. somehow what's important is that I cover the whole set. And so, in fact, let me even, maybe I should, so it's hard to know where to go from here. Maybe I should prove claim one granted these 2 points, and then I should come back to why is this fact true? And because I think otherwise you don't see where it's going at all. So let me at least prove claim one. So all this is perfectly clear. So proof of claim one, given one and two. And so the idea is I want the volume of K0 plus TK1. And I know that the gradient of this map, according to this, actually covers this set here. And so I can rewrite this using gradient psi as a change of variables. This is, of course, this is an integral over k0 plus tk1 dz. But I can rewrite that using a change of variables x equals, as z equals gradient psi of x, as an integral over rn determinant of V2, the Hessian of this map. And then I have determinant of psi 1 of x plus t psi 2 of, what was this, psi 0 and psi 1 rather. And the determinant is a multilinear thing. And so the point is to reduce this geometrical fact to an algebraic fact. And so now determinant of two matrices, A plus TB, is a polynomial of degree n in T. And let me call the coefficients mi, or even mn minus I. And let me again normalize them to include an n choose I. And this here is the definition of the mnis. And so these are sometimes called mixed discriminants. And that allows me to rewrite this integral as a sum as I counts from 0 to n, ti, n choose I, the n minus I mixed discriminant of d2 psi naught of x, d2 psi 1 of x, and integrate with respect to volume. And so this basically gives me a formula. Not only does it tell me it's a polynomial, but it gives me a formula for Vm n minus I in terms of an integral of Mn minus I. That's the conclusion of claim one. And notice that And so I still want to say something about this. So the claim for so to check one. As x tends to infinity, if I have some sequence tending to infinity, but in such a way that its direction tends to a particular constant on the unit sphere, then gradient phi I of xk converges. To a boundary point on this set, and moreover, that this boundary point satisfies that it's parallel to this direction. So. Is the following. If this is my k0 and my k1, I have these maps from Rn to k0 and from Rn to k1. And my claim is that if I take a sequence of points, x1, x2, x3, and so on, which march off to infinity in, say, the horizontal direction, that the corresponding sequence of points over here, grad psi 0 of xi, is going to march off, it's going to converge to this limit point, y 0, where the normal to this set is horizontal. And similarly, the images of these points under gradient psi 1 are going to converge to a y1, where the normal is horizontal, which is to say parallel to that guy up there. So these are the gradient psi 1 of xk's. And so when I add these two sets together, who knows what this thing looks like, but the rightmost point in this set is it has to come from this rightmost point has to be y0 plus ty1, because any other linear combination of a point in here and a point in here will the image of this point, it lies to the left, strictly to the left of y0. And the image of t times this point lies strictly to the left of the image of t times y1, and so the linear combination of two points here has to lie strictly to the left of this point. And so so if I've checked this claim, then I know that gradient psi of xk will converge as k goes to infinity to some y, which equals y naught plus t1, where the outer unit normal to k naught plus tk1 is n. And so then that basically means that as I move around the boundaries of these two domains, if I go to the point where the normal goes upwards, the image of the sum of these two points under the gradient of this function is going to go to the point where this goes upwards, and so on, that where this point's at a 45-degree angle up to the left, the image of this point plus this point has to go to the unique point, because this is a strictly convex set, if both of these are, where this guy points up to the left, and so on. And so somehow that tells me that the whole boundary of the set is going to be approached in the limit as k goes to infinity, and that tells me that this connected image of Rn under this smooth map actually has to reach the boundary of this convex set, and so that tells me that this has to be equal, max.
Why does it have to reach Rn for the
moment? Okay, so if you believe that this is C2, this is a continuous map, and so this is a, it's a, what do you call it? It's contractible. It's this has the same, this thing is homeomorphic to the ball in Rn. This is a homeomorphic image. I wasn't trying to claim that it was closed. I was only trying to claim that the gradient of psi of Rn is actually equal to, let's say, the interior of k0 bar plus tk1 bar. So are you happier with that? Okay, that's the only claim. I mean, I only need this in order to do this change of variables up here. To say that the volume of k0 plus tk1 is equal to the integral of that determinant over Rn. But that volume doesn't care whether I'm looking at an open set or a closed set. Other questions? So let's see. So I'm supposed to say, why is this true? So take any point, so by strict convexity, this limit of yi is unique. So strict convexity of ki implies n selects yi uniquely. Xk be any subsequence of the above sequence which converges. And I claim that I claim y infinity equals y. And if I can equals yi. And if I can do that, then I'm done, because that shows that this is a compact set over here, because ki was bounded. And so every subsequence of that has a convergent subsequence, and they all have to converge to the same limit, and so the original sequence converges. And if not, at least we know monotonicity, which tells us that gradient phi I of xk minus gradient phi I of xl is bigger than dotted with xk minus xl. Actually, let me make this x. I know this is always true. And for any x fixed, as k tends to infinity, this thing is getting closer and closer to a large multiple of. So x is some fixed point. I take a point very far out in the sequence, which is converging to infinity in the horizontal direction. The vector joining x to xk is getting more and more horizontal. So it tends to large multiple of n hat. And so as I let k go to infinity, I get that y infinity minus grad psi I of x dotted with n hat has to be bigger than 0 for all x in R. And well, we already said that this thing is supposed to be giving me a these gradients here are actually onto ki, k0, and k1, and so I can reach any point in the interior of here. The interior of k0 is the image of Rn under gradient psi0, and so any point here is reached by some point x in Rn. So each, since a homeomorphism, each y in ki is the image of some x in Rn. And so I can replace this by for all y in ki. And so that tells me that y infinity has to be the rightmost point in ki, and that's the picture that I drew here. Is it clear? Other questions? So maybe this is a good place to take a 5-minute break. And so then after the break, everything always takes twice as long as you expected to. After the break, I will talk about the inequality. I will use the formula at the top of the board here to prove the inequalities of corollary 2 or corollary 1, whatever it was. But of course, the strategy is to reduce these geometrical inequalities relating the mixed volumes VNI using algebraic inequalities relating the mixed discriminants MNI. And so I have to begin by telling you, where did the algebraic inequalities come from? So the strategy of proof is that first, so somehow the all the, what do you say? So the proof of corollary is that MIAB is bigger than squared is bigger than MI plus 1 AB, MI minus 1 AB, for where A and B are n by n matrices and M is a mixed discriminant. And then I use this in that formula together with these two equations here in order to conclude corollary 2. Okay, take a break. Yeah. It's at the very top. The very top.
Right. How do you know that the Jacobian of phi is non-singular? That can be a point from zero.
Right, so that's this thing here, right?
I mean, not singular and not equal to zero. The Jacobian is equal to 0.1. Not the phi, but the Jacobian.
Mm-hmm.
So why is it in injective, for example?
Well, if
it is
okay, if you believe that it's C2.
Uh-huh.
Then you believe that that equation is satisfied to
for each I, yes.
For each x and for each I.
Yes.
Okay. So that means that all of the eigenvalues, the Hessian of psi at x, are non-zero.
Sure.
So now you want to take the Hessian of this function here.
Yes.
So there are a bunch of non-zero positive eigenvalues here.
Yes.
Plus small multiple of another bunch of positive eigenvalues. So, I mean, when I add two positive numbers, I have to get a positive number.
Is that true? If you hold several positive matrices, it's
Sure. True in finite dimensions, anyway.
Yes.
I'm not so sure.
Not for which reason it's absolutely true, but if you don't just have eigenvalues, right? If you diagonalize them, then you wouldn't be able to diagonalize them simultaneously. But yes.
So you want to compute something like this over all x equals 1, right? And the int is attained. It's in finite dimensions, the int is a min. And so this is attained at some x naught. Exactly. If it's not attained, then it's a bigger problem.
And I want to ask you, when is it possible to see you to speak about the project or the thing that I have to write up?
My suggestion was to do a can you do a summary of Ambrogio Giglio Savary?
Of the whole thing?
Yeah.
You mean the new thing or the Wasserstein tooling?
Whatever they have, sort of do a review of their paper.
Hold on, there's two papers, right? There's the, like almost the book thing.
Yeah.
This is the one.
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah. What are you talking about?
I thought maybe like the previous.
What
paper?
The book is, of course, there are two things in the book, right? There's
piecewise approximation.
Yeah, part of it is also not. I mean, it takes place in a very general framework, which is not necessarily the Wasserstein space. Until the Wasserstein space is the application or something like that.
Yes.
Anyhow, you don't have to review the whole book, but highlights.
Okay.
What is that important? So somehow this would be useful for me because I would like to know what's in there.
Uh-huh.
So it would be useful if you could sort of give a presentation at the end of the course on this. Does that sound?
Yeah.
But the oral presentation is going to be like, I don't know, maybe 40 minutes at the most, something like that. So the claim is that as a sequence of points tends to infinity in the horizontal direction, that the image of these points in the closed convex set tends to that boundary point, which has a horizontal normal. I'm sorry, what? Yeah, right. Then you approximate it. You first prove everything you want to prove for strictly convex KI. And then you you want to approximate. Yeah. Okay, Boris. No, apparently I'm not going to get to the geodesics. It's pretty clear. Hi, Greg. How was your trip to Austin?
Very nice.
Good.
Very nice. Warm though.
Yes, I imagine. It will get colder here. let me grab a drink.
Yeah.
Here, there's been what?
Today it's okay, but last week was like around not far from 0.6 years.
Uh-huh. There was ice on the ground one morning.
Yeah. I went this weekend to the island.
Yes.
And,
here?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
On the shore, the lake, there was some ice also there.
Huh. Yeah, I saw it on Spadina, circle
Spadina.
Ice, yeah, at the beginning of the week. Whoops. I'm sorry? It shouldn't be there. You mean it should be just over pi? I believe you. Yeah, are you sure there's not an over 2 here?
Yeah, if it's 2, then the normal.
Then there's a 2. Yeah. Yeah, right. But, oh, you did it. So, you have a much more complicated trick.
Okay. This is AF2.
You square it, and that's what I do too. Mm-hmm. Right, there's 2 there, so that's the 1 in the end. Well, I believe you. Okay, so were there questions? Was it, you could follow it? Okay. Great. So actually, in a certain sense, the interesting part are these inequalities. But since I don't want to lose the thread, maybe let me just finish the argument that if you have these inequalities for matrices and mixed discriminants, then you get the inequalities we want for the VIs. And whoops. So actually, I really don't want this inequality. I want the corollary to this inequality. So this has I copies of A, and this has 0 copies of A, and this has N copies of A, and so this must be I over N, and this must be N minus I over N. Okay, so this is actually the inequality that I want for matrices. So if I have that inequality for matrices, this is bigger than integral Rn. M0 to the I over nth power times mn to the n minus I over nth power d2 psi naught of x, d2 psi 1 of x, and integrated over Rn. And but the m0 is basically the determinant of psi 1. The I over nth power, and Mn is the determinant of psi naught, and now I finally want to use this Monge-Ampère equation that we had at the beginning, which tells me that this is k. 1 to the I over N times K0 to the N minus I over N times the integral over Rn of this normalized Gaussian, which so Najma tells me that maybe there shouldn't be a 2 in the denominator, but so I over N plus N minus I over N. And these add up to 1, and so now I'm integrating something that has integral 1 over all of Rn. And so this is the 0 of k0 k1 to the I over n, and this is vn of k0 k1 to the n minus I over n. And that was the desired inequality, times 1. Sorry, by which inequality? What? Getting from here to here? Yes. Can you prove the second one? Yes, right. Right. So you want to know if I knew this inequality, can you prove claim 2? Not by this method. So what goes wrong? Yep. So I think the answer is because it goes the wrong way. But if you can find a way to do it, it would be very nice. So the point is that you get you have vi of k naught k one squared is equal to the integral of mi of k naught k one mi of Hessian psi naught Hessian psi one the volume. And so using this guy here, it's no trouble to write, this is bigger than, of course, there's a square. I would like to have a square, and so that brings the square root here. And so it's bigger than the square root of mi plus 1, d2 psi naught of x, d2 psi 1 of x. And times mi minus 1 of d2 psi naught of x, d2 psi 1 of x. And on the other hand, you have that the product, vi minus 1 of k naught k1 times vi plus 1 of k naught k1 is equal to the product of two integrals, and so you need somehow to what would be great would be an inequality like this. You need the integral of these two functions, the product of these two integrals, to be less than or equal to the integral of the product, but that kind of inequality isn't true in general. And so somehow these particular parameterizations, psi naught and psi 1, have been chosen so that the determinant is something simple that I can integrate. And that doesn't help me at all with an expression like this or an expression like this. It only helps me when I can reduce it to determinants under the integral and then get something simple in the end. And so, somehow if I want to prove that this squared dominates these things, I need to somehow pick a better parameterization that's maybe not related to the determinant, but to something more complicated that involves maybe solving some kind of Hessian equation with, instead of the Monge-Ampère operator, something like this. Yeah.
So I suppose this was not the original
right. Right.
Do you know anything about the way it was
originally? Yeah, I've seen it several times, but I certainly couldn't reproduce it. No, it's, these were proved in the 30s. So it's somehow more primitive, more geometrical. Right, and these are the algebraic inequalities. This is what I don't know. And actually, I should even say that these are still a special, we still haven't got the full family. This is, I only talked about a special case. The full family of these inequalities, I will just write them down. I will say nothing about them. The full family says, suppose I have a collection of sets up to, let's say, n of them in Rn. And then if I look at the volume of Ti, Ki, where all the Ti's are positive, the doing the same thing I did here, you can show that this is a polynomial, homogeneous of degree n in the Ti's. So this is a sum as this is a sum over all multi-indices of order n. T1 alpha 1, T2 alpha 2, and so on up to Tn alpha n. And then some coefficients that depend on the Ki. And so how should I say it? V has n slots. And in the first alpha I slots, you put K1. In the next alpha 2 slots, you put K2, and so on. And in the last alpha N slots, you put KN. So sometimes you'll have one copy of each of these matrices. Sometimes you'll have all copies of the same matrices. And there should also be a combinatorial normalization factor. And it looks like this. And then the inequality, then the most, the sort of general inequality says that this thing squared is bigger than what I get if I pick any two. This is actually symmetric. V is a symmetric function of all the matrices. And it's bigger than what I get if I take any pair of them, say K1 and K2, and I replicate K1 twice, and then I have K3 through Kn, as opposed to replicating K2 twice, and then having K3 through Kn. So, and of course, there's a, so my VNs are related to these guys by my VI of KL is equal to this V with K counted I times and L counted N minus I times. And maybe up to a factor of, so this is roughly what's going on. And so these inequalities that I'm gunning for are the special cases of this where you have only two distinct matrices in here. And you look at changing the number of, the first matrix occurs I times, the second matrix occurs N minus I times, and you look at the case of changing that to I minus 1 and I plus 1 as the first copy. So I just want to say something about where do these algebraic inequalities come from. And so this goes back to somehow Newton's theorem. So it says that if a polynomial has n real roots, then pi squared is bigger than pi plus 1, pi minus 1. And so let's see. And so the proof of Newton's theorem is by induction. And in the case n equals 2, we're looking at the polynomial p2 plus p1x plus p2x squared. And we know that b squared minus there should have been an n choose I here. So then there's a 2 here. And the discriminant for this polynomial to have two real roots, b squared minus 4ac is 4p1 squared minus 4p0 p2. And I'm sorry, this should have been a p0. And so if this is strictly positive, then I have two real roots. And if it's non-negative, I have one real root with multiplicity 2. And so here I'm counting with multiplicity. And so n equals 2, it reduces to the quadratic formula. And then the induction goes the following way. If it's assume the theorem for Pn, and of course if degree P is equal to n plus 1, and Px has n distinct real roots, that implies that between every pair of distinct real roots, there has to be a point where the derivative of P vanishes by the mean value theorem, and so n plus 1 distinct real roots. That implies p prime of x has which in particular implies that the degree of p prime of x is equal to n. And now it's just a question of checking that the combinatorics work out. So p of x is the sum up to n of n factorial I factorial n minus I factorial of Pn minus I xi, so P prime of x, this is a sum from 0, this is up to n plus 1, so I should be careful, this is n plus 1 factorial, this is n plus 1 minus I factorial, this is n plus 1 minus I. This is the sum from I up to n plus 1, n plus 1 factorial over an I comes down, so I have an I minus 1 factorial, n plus 1 minus I factorial, n plus 1 minus I, x to the I minus 1, and I would probably, it's better to make a change of index. And maybe I pull out an n plus 1. This would be j factorial. This would be n minus j factorial, if as long as j is I minus 1. And right, so if so, then the theorem, the inductive hypothesis tells me that Pj squared is bigger than Pj minus 1, Pj plus 1, for all j equals 0 up to, 1 up to n minus 1. And that gives me all the inequalities I want except one, namely the case j equals n. And because this was, let's see, this is an n minus j. You're right. So I must be getting this, is that right? So you're saying I have pi squared is bigger than pi plus 2. For I counting from j was I minus 1, so 2 to n, something is, no. Oh, sorry. The point is that P0, in my labeling scheme, P0 is the coefficient of IN, or P0 is the coefficient of IN plus 1. And so the inequality that I don't have is the one that involves PN plus 1, that I lose when I differentiate. So this is great. So, I'm missing... n squared bigger than pn minus 1, pn plus 1, and I can't get this from differentiating, so what do I do? So this is, I'm already working under this this generosity assumption that the roots are distinct. I might as well make them distinct real non-zero roots. And then I can look at the polynomial. So I consider instead x to the, I guess, n plus 1 p of 1 over x. And this is also a degree n plus 1 polynomial with n plus 1 distinct real roots. And basically what this does is it reverses the ordering of the p's. So this is actually the polynomial I counts from 0 to n plus 1 and choose I, pi x to the I. And so I apply the above argument to this polynomial and I get the last inequality. You handle the case where the roots are not distinct by limits, by perturbing them all a little bit. If you have n real roots, you perturb them all a little bit. You prove the inequality you want. All of the terms here depend continuously on the roots, so I let the perturbation go to zero. And it's nice to observe what actually are the roots, in question. So, for example, if px is a product of x minus ri, I counting from 1 to n, then this product looks like x to the n plus x to the n minus 1 times r1 plus r2 up to rn. And so I can divide by n here if I multiply by n out here. And then the next term has x to the n minus 2. And so then I take off pairs of the ri's. So it's r1, r3 plus r1, rn, and then plus r2, r3, plus r2, rn, and so on all the way down to rn minus 1, rn. And there are, n choose 2 such pairs, and so if I normalize this by dividing by n choose 2 and multiplying by n choose 2. This is the first elementary symmetric polynomial in the RIs. This is the second elementary symmetric polynomial in the RIs. And so this is I equals 0 up to n of xi, n choose I, s, n minus I, Si. Where this is the, it was n minus I after all. This is the n minus I symmetric polynomial in the roots. And so what we just proved is that for any given set of roots, S I squared is bigger than S I minus 1, S I plus 1. And it's actually, so another corollary from this that's very easy to check is that S1 is bigger than square root of S2, which is bigger than square root of S3, cube root of S3, all the way down to the product of the roots, which is Sn, and the root of that. So somehow at the ends of this thing are the domination of the arithmetic by the geometric mean, and in between are all these other means, where you take the average of all pairs of roots and divide it by the number of pairs of roots and then take the square root, or the average of all triples, all distinct triples of roots, divided by the number of distinct triples of roots and take the cube root, and so on. So, so actually what we've managed to prove so far we have this inequality in the case B equals I. Because if you go back and you think about the definitions of the M's, so what the definition was that the determinant of A plus TB is equal to the sum of T to the I and choose I M I of A B. And when sorry, maybe I should have said when A equals I. So if I put B equals I here, then this is great. This is going to be the product of the eigenvalues of, so I should have given you hypothesis for this. So assume A is a symmetric matrix and B is a symmetric matrix, then this holds true. And moreover, you can derive this corollary if all the RIs are non-negative. So the corollary holds only for non-negative RIs. But for the theorem, I don't actually care whether the roots are positive or not. And so the point is that as long as these matrices are symmetric, then this determinant is written as a product of the eigenvalues of the A, and so this is exactly a polynomial with the roots minus AI. And so this thing here would be exactly, except for a factor that counts the number of minus signs that we've gone wrong by. So this is T minus negative AI. This is a symmetric polynomial in A1 through, this is, should have been an N minus I, huh? And this should have been an N minus I, A1 through AN. And then there's a negative 1 here to the power, I guess it's N minus I. And so, so what we proved for these symmetric polynomials in the AI immediately is gets inherited by this thing here, because the minus ones only occur in every other term, so either both of them are here and they get squared, or else there are none over here, but there's one here and one here and they get squared. So the inequalities that we just checked for the S's are the inequalities for the M's once you realize this minus one has gone away. And so I'm sort of out of time. It's really just a couple of minutes, but I won't do it today to show that once you've done this for B, the identity matrix, so if B is not equal to I, you use the following trick. That determinant of A plus TB is equal to the determinant of B times the determinant of B to the minus 1/2 A B to the minus 1/2 plus TI. As long as B has no negative eigenvalues, then I can invert it and take the square root. And so I apply the inequalities I know already to this thing, and then I use this formula to recover inequalities for this thing. And once again, you do it under a non-degeneracy hypothesis on B, and you can handle the degenerate case in the limit. After you've proved this inequality, as long as B doesn't have a zero eigenvalue, you can check by letting the smallest eigenvalue of B tend to zero that you get it even when B does have zero eigenvalues. So I guess that's a good place to stop and take any questions.